You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 557. I think other filmmakers are inherently more brilliant than me, but I know that I can work harder than they can. James Cameron.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, today on the show, we have an old buddy of mine, a producer by the name of Daniel Solinger. Now, Daniel has been a UPM, a line producer, executive producer, and producer, and has been working in this business for over 30 years. We've had the pleasure of working on a few projects together over the years. And he has a new movie out called Clean, starring Oscar-winning actor Adrian Brody. Now, Daniel and I get into really down the rabbit hole of what it's really like to be a line producer, to be a UPM, what it is to produce independent films, how to work the budgets a little bit, how to work within unions, how to deal with all the headaches that come along with making independent film. And it is a treasure trove of information. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Daniel Solinger. I'd like to welcome to the show Daniel Solinger. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing great.
Good to see you, my friend. You and I have we have fought the same battles. We've been in the same trenches. We have walked over the same bodies. In independent film, man. So I was so happy when you reached out to me about coming on the show because you're a wealth of information. You've definitely done the indie film hustle.
And then 30 some. 30 years of indie film hustling, yes.
And then some. So I have to let's start the conversation, my friend, is how and why did you decide to get into the insanity that is the film industry, let alone the indie film industry?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I just want to start off just saying, like, how much fun it has been to watch Indie Film Hustle grow and expand. And, you know, you're such a great entrepreneur, too. I always use you as an example to young filmmakers who are, you know, maybe have a movie that doesn't have stars or whatever. And I say, you just have to find a unique way to do it. I know this guy, Alex, who when the iPhone came out, he took his short film, he turned it into an app, and sold it on the App Store. Like, you just have to find the new way to do it to monetize your film and make it successful, you know? So I love what you do, and I'm glad to be here. I mean, the long story is that when I was in high school, my parents did not want us to watch movies or television. They wanted us to read books. I became very rebellious. I got kicked out of one high school. I went to another high school. I got kicked out of that high school, and I went to the end of the line, which was a night school for sort of disciplinary problem children. And while I was in night school, I met another kid who was kicked out of this thing called the Fine Arts Center. This is in Greenville, South Carolina. And he was studying film. And it was just like a light bulb went off. I was like, you can study film? Like, that can be a career? Like, it just blew my mind. And I had no experience whatsoever, but I had been writing a lot of poetry, and I submitted all my poetry to the Fine Arts Center. And God bless Dennis Yusey, the teacher there. He accepted me into the program. I'd go half the day to my regular high school, and then I went half the day and studied film at the Fine Arts Center. And, you know, then I applied to NYU and went to NYU Film School and, you know, built a career from that. I love making movies. I love telling stories, you know. And when I was getting out of NYU, there was sort of like a decision point. Like, do I want to be a PA on big movies, you know, or do I want to produce music videos? Because I was producing music videos before I graduated. And I said, you know what, I want to be a producer. I'm just going to start producing music videos. And someday I'll be producing big movies, but I'm just going to produce because that's what I like to do, you know. I don't want a PA for 10 years. You know, I meet, you know, God bless them, you know, and nothing wrong with it. But I meet like 60-year-old second ADs and just wonder, like, I just didn't want to get caught in like a smaller role on a bigger movie. Like, I wanted to have the enjoyment of producing from the beginning, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've run into a couple of 45, 50-year-old PAs, and that's tough. It's a tough gig, man. It's a tough gig, yeah. Getting caught up in that. And that's nothing that's just wrong with it, man. But PAing is a young man's game, my friend.
It is.
Things hurt now that did not hurt in your 20s. Like walking.
It's so true.
I mean, if you know when it's going to rain by the pain in your knee, you might have jumped the shark. Right. Now, you made your bones coming up as a first AD and a line producer in a UPM. Can you tell me the difference between a UPM, a unit production manager, and a line producer? Because that's a confusion a lot of filmmakers have.
Sure. Well, yeah, I have a lot to say about it, actually. So I'm a DGA UPM. I'm a Directors Guild of America UPM. And even if I'm doing a job as a producer and it's a DGA show, I will take the UPM credit so that I get the, you know, health, pension, and welfare benefits and everything. So there's still a lot of room. And I'm not the only one. There's like huge producers like Daniel Lupi. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, big Hollywood producers that when they produce a movie, they are the UPM as well. So the UPM is the person in charge of, you know, breaking down the script, creating a schedule, turning that information, the breakdown in the schedule, into a budget, then hiring the crew and making sure everything stays on track in terms of schedule and budget all the way through till the end of production. So that's what a UPM does. The line producer, I think, is a little bit more of an indie role, and it's a step up. So the UPM will work underneath the line producer. The line producer will be their supervisor. And the line producer looks at more at the big picture of the production, and the UPM is making sure lunch is there on time and taking care of the smaller details to make sure that all the smaller details are hitting all the places that they're supposed to be.
So you, even though you might be line producing, you'll take a UPM credit.
Even if I'm just full producer, you know, I'll take a UPM credit if it's a Directors Guild of America movie. Absolutely. Right.
And you being a DG and you being a union DG, a union member, you have to basically work on projects that are union, DGA generally.
Well, luckily in my category, that's a big loophole because yes, I cannot work on a non-union movie as a unit production manager. I can work on a non-union movie as a line producer, as a producer. So it's a lot harder for union ADs because there's no other sort of title that really fits.
Right.
You know, so and the DGA is they are really serious about it too. If I work on a non-union movie as a unit production manager, my penalty if they find out and discipline me is my entire salary from that project. So it's a very serious deal.
Well, we won't get into how fair that is or not fair that is. Now, are there
there's other things you can do? You can go FICOR, which is financial core, so that you can get the benefits of being union and be non-union.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I mean, there's ways to deal with it, but if you're doing everything by the book, I mean, that's the potential penalty that you face.
Well, yeah, I know. Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino, George Lucas, they're all non-GGA, and they still work on DGA projects and films, right. But they're FICOR, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Yeah. So and it's like the DGA doesn't generally like to talk a lot about that. Like we don't talk about Quentin Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez. No. But no, I mean, listen, I've heard nothing great but great things about the DGA. I know that they have probably the best benefits package out of all the unions in Hollywood. Pension package. I mean, it's pretty insane. Yeah. It's
very nice. And beyond that too, I'm a huge fan of the DGA. You know, a decade ago, they spent $2 million to commission a study about where they thought online viewing would go, right? At the time, you know, I think YouTube was just starting to really kick in. You know, people were doing webisodes. I don't know if you remember those.
Oh, yeah.
But there was very, very, very little revenue in it. And because they commissioned this study, they learned what anchor points they needed to put into the contracts so that people who were working in new media felt free to go DGA. But as it grew, like the DGA would grow with it and the parity of compensation would grow with it. And it's directors in UPM. So it's like the best run union. You know, there's very little drama. Everything's like boom, boom, boom by the book, very healthy pension. Their reserves in their pension, you know, their reserves for the operating overall are like really abundant. You know, and it's just an incredibly well-run union. I think the best union. And I think all the other unions follow them. So, you know, I think in terms of the contract cycles, like DGA is like the first up. And then a lot of the other unions will sort of follow their lead and when they go into their negotiations.
Yeah, if you can get it, it's great. It really is. But you have to follow the rules. There's no question about it. Do not play around. They don't play.
Yeah. And rules, you know, rules are there for a reason too. I mean, you know, when you think about set safety, liability.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, the rules can be restrictive and challenging at times, but they're there to protect the members and, you know, and the institution as a whole and filmmaking in general, you know?
Now you and I worked on a project years ago, called Without Men, starring the lovely Eva Longoria, who was just on the show. And that was not planned, by the way. I didn't plan on having you. You reached out to me before Eva was even scheduled to be on the show, but it just so was funny. And I talked to her a little bit about the show, about the movie. She's like, oh my God, I forgot. You know, that's amazing. I can't believe you worked on it. And that movie was a really interesting experience for me because we're going back. It was released 11 years ago that was released. And we were working on it in 2010. I think it was being filmed in 2010, something like that. And it had Christian Slater in it. It had Kay Castillo,
Paul Rodriguez.
Yeah, Paul Rodriguez. It had a really great cast. And it was shot outside of LA. It was, I think, outside the whatchamacallit? What is that?
The zone. They call it the zone. It's 30 miles radius from the Screen Actors Guild headquarters. Yeah, so it was outside the zone. Yeah,
it was outside the zone. So technically, you could do a non-union scenario there, and I think that's for crew, not for DGA or other things, but for crew. So I remember when we were on that project was flipped. Now, can you explain what flipping a movie means and how you handled it?
Okay. Yes, definitely. So flipping is when the crew decides that they want to organize and collectively bargain with the producers. And so, you know, I do both union and non-union work, both as, you know, as a union member, you know, in my category, but also, you know, all the other trade unions involved. And usually when I start a project, we make a decision. It always comes down to money. Can we afford to go union? Like my default is like I would prefer to go union because union, like your basement level quality of work is higher.
Period. Sure.
It's like your worst guy on a union crew is better than the average guy on a non-union crew. In my experience, just my experience. So, but you know, there's a tremendous cost impact of that. I think at the moment it's around an extra $220 per day per person, just in benefits. So that adds up to six figures very quickly. And if, you know, if you're really trying to, you know, get something done, you know, sometimes there's just not the room to do that, which was the case in that movie. By the way, love Eva, loved working with her, mm-hmm. never, such a wonderful experience. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we had a very limited, we actually didn't have full financing. You know, we had enough to get it in the can. We didn't even have the money for post, I think, when we started out. And which is why I think it took another 8 months before we were like, okay, let's
Literally, I had all the raw files on a hard drive, on multiple hard drives sitting in my office. And I would call you every month. I'm like, hey, man, do you want me to finish this Eva Longoria Christian Slater movie?
Well, that was the reason why.
Okay.
And so, like I said, we had just you know, we had just enough to get us through production. So we told everybody going into it, this is non-union film. When we hired the crew, you know, we can't afford to go union. You know, we're going to have to do this non-union, and mostly we hired non-union people. I find that when you have talent at a certain visibility, that becomes more and more untenable. I believe I don't know who or where. I think that they unions look at a project and they say, look, if you've got Eva Longoria or, you know, whoever, I'm just using her in the example of this movie, like you should really be union. And I think that's sort of like the mindset, and you know, and they're entitled to that. So then what happens is you're shooting with this crew that you believe is non-union, and it doesn't matter if they're union members or not. It's a little bit more difficult if they are union members to stay non-union, because the union then applies pressure on them. If the DP is union, you know, they'll get a call from the union and say, look, it looks like you're working on a non-union production. You know, that's not okay. You know, we need help, you know, organizing the shoot. And by organizing, if you can get 50% of the crew to sign on and agree to be represented, then the union then becomes the representative for the crew. And what happens is they stop work. You know, they usually do it on a lunch break or at the beginning of a day. And no work happens until you work out a deal with a contract with the union. And that did happen on that project.
It was really interesting, because when I was coming up, there was a movie that I worked on in Florida, and it was, believe it or not, it was like $1 million budget, but most of that money was going towards cast. It was a very poorly run project. And back in those years, mid-2000s, early 2000s. And I remember the day I was doing all the post on it, and it had like an Academy Award nominee in it and a couple other people. And then the union showed up, because it was non-union. This was in Florida, because Florida's a right-to-work state, so you don't have to go. But the union came because they saw the trucks and everything. And they're like, so, and luckily that day, none of the major cast was there. It was all kind of like the non-bankable names were there. And all of a sudden, they looked and they saw the camera that we were using. And it was the DVX-100A Panasonic mini DV camera, shooting $1 million movie with the Panasonic DVA-100 mini.
Wow.
And they said, literally, they're like, you guys have a great day. And literally all of them just walked out the door. They were done. They were just like, these guys are obviously, I don't care if you've got Meryl Streep here, you're shooting with this camera, you obviously don't have the money to pay us. but that's the world. And these are the kind of things that UPMs and line producers have to deal with, that the filmmakers generally don't need to even know about until they go, why isn't my crew working?
Why is the crew across the street? It's call time.
Exactly. At that point, they go, oh.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I want to go in a little bit more detail about Without Men and the flip, because now that it's 10 years past, I feel like I can divulge some things that I wouldn't normally have divulged in the time. So you can, as a producer, you can usually see a flip coming. It's not a surprise the day that the crew is not working. There's usually, you know, there's back
rumbles.
You get
there's rumbles.
You feel it. feel it happening. So I saw this coming, and this is a project that it was all in one location. We had this great situation. It was a film school. I don't think they exist anymore, actually. The name of the film school escapes me, but they had this soundstage and they had this Mexican village backlot, and it was perfect for our movie. And so we struck a deal, you know, we hired students too. And so we just landed at this film school and we shot our whole movie on their backlot and soundstage. It was a great situation, especially, you know, with limited means. So whenever a flip happens, there's some negotiating that goes on. You know, like you can get, there's some things that they will not budge about on their contract. There's like minimum staffing requirements. You have to pay all the pension and welfare retroactively. There's a lot that you're not going to be able to negotiate, but there's all these other deal points that you can negotiate that are more negotiable. So when I knew the flip was coming, the morning of the flip was there, and the crew went across the street and they all had their walkie-talkies. And so I went around to all the film students and I said, okay, our AD staff, it wasn't Flip DGA, so our AD staff was still on. But, you know, I said, okay, you're the camera person, you're the this, you're the that, and I gave all the students assignments. And I said, use the walkies a lot, just every, I told the AD, anything, you're moving the camera over 2 inches, put it on the walkie, right? And then I waited. Right. And the union representative was expecting me to call him and be like, let's work out something. We're not getting anything done. But instead, the whole crew was sitting there listening to their walkies. And there's like, all right, roll camera. OK, we're moving on, you know, and we were just shooting without them, you know, and they were flipping out. And so they started to put a lot of pressure on their union representative to contact me and work out some sort of deal. And I may have even like not answered the guy's phone call the first couple of times he was trying to call me. And he finally got a hold of me. He's like, look, man, we really have to work something out here. I was like, you know, okay, well, I'll talk to you. Why don't you come in and talk? And I worked out like the best possible deal I've ever had on a flip. I've been flipped about 7 times, but just the barest minimums of like what I had to comply with. And then, you know, the crew came back and everybody hugged and we went on and, you know, the unions. It's a good to have a win-win. The union won because they flipped us, and we won because it was like really not a high impact on us financially. And then we got the movie made, and that happened, I guess, by lunchtime. I think the crew was back. You know?
Oh wow! So it was pretty quick.
Of course, the camera department like destroyed the cards that the students had been shooting with, but. but it turned out to be like a very effective. Gambit.
It almost sounded like a hostage situation. Like you have to call in and like they're not picking up the call. What do they want? I don't know. We'd send food and we'll send out one, we'll release one hostage. Like it.
Right. Exactly.
Now, are there any tricks of the trade that you can kind of give advice on when it comes to line producing a project or UPMing a project?
Well, I just heard this week, and I love this. Somebody said, you know, Daniel, we're going to fix it in prep.
Oh my God, that's amazing. That's such
so usually you're on set. It's like, oh, we'll fix it in post. No, fix it in prep. You know, like that's the best thing you can do to yourself. Even if you don't have the money to, you know, pay people to do like extensive prep, just do as much prep as you can. I work on this TV show called Double Cross. And the producers on that show, they'll start out months in advance, location scout. They'll do all this prep work on their own so that by the time it gets the week before shooting, like so much is done. And the crew just sort of drops into this situation that they've already set up. You know, it's like they know all their cast. They know all their locations. They know they've got, you know, they know all their props. They know how they're doing everything. And the crew just sort of drops in and they go. And you know, I don't think that's an interesting way to work. That's not the way I would normally do it, but it's amazing how much, if you do enough prep, you won't have problems during production. It's just that simple, you know?
Absolutely. Prep is, it's so undervalued. prepare. Now, exactly. What are some mistakes that you see filmmakers make when they're trying to produce their first low budget independent film? I'm sure you've seen, you've been witness might have even been a part of early in your career?
Oh, no, I was just thinking about all the mistakes I've made. Like, I don't even know where to start, you know, but
top five mistakes.
Yeah. Well, just back for a second of what you were saying about that shoot in Florida. You know, I do a lot of, you know, breakdown schedules and budgets for movies that are fundraising or trying to get greenlit and what right. have you. And if there is too much discrepancy between the above the line and the below the line, that is not a good look.
That's so you mean so 750 for the talent and 250 right. per production? Not, a little heavy on the talent side.
Well, a good rule of thumb is that those should line up. So if you're spending $500,000 above the line, you should be spending at least $500,000 below the line. Like,
got it.
Like that's to me, that's responsible producing. So yeah. So if the ratio between what the above the line and what the below the line are getting is too off, that's a recipe for disaster for a lot of reasons, you know, because you're above the line or in a movie that looks like garbage, you know, like, and then they're not happy about that. And then you have to deal with the repercussions of that, or they're expecting a certain level of professionalism that you just can't afford if you've done right. it that way, you know? So the stars, your big name stars or whatever that you're expecting to use on your marketing and bring the money back, you know, they arrive on set and they're like, this is a joke. I can't work in this under these conditions. And, you know, and it causes, you know, it can cause just tremendous problems. So there should always be a parity between, you know, at least a 1-to-1 ratio between the above the line and the below the line spend. That would be my piece of advice. Number one.
All right. Yeah. Cause I mean, there's been so many, God, there's just so many things like, well, there's one thing I remember when I was doing my movie, my $20 million movie for the mob back in the day. I had the pleasure of being mentored by a legendary first AD, he was a line producer on some David Fincher films. Like he was the real deal. Like he worked on Love Story in the 70s. Like he'd been all right. He was in the room on Taxi Driver when Robert was like, are you talking to me? Like he was in that room. Wow. He was in the room with Marty. So he was a New York guy. He was an East Coast guy. So I had the pleasure of working with him for months. And he trained me on taught me on how to break down a movie, how to schedule a movie. And then I discovered how he was able to hide money in other departments. Can you talk about that little trick? And it's not notorious or anything like that. It's an actual really very valuable tool to have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because when you're creating a budget, you know, first of all, things happen, surprises happen, things come up. You've always need to be aware of that, number one. So, you should always have overtime budgeted, some overtime. I usually start at 10%, and every budget I do, there's like a 10% overtime. You should always have a contingency in place. And hopefully you don't spend it, but trying to do, this is another mistake I see a lot of young producers make, where they'll like make $1 million film and then their contingency will be like $10,000, you know, like you should have a 10% contingency, you know,
right.
And, but then also inside the budget, there should be areas or places that you know that you've over budgeted, or, you know, like I can get a much better deal with this vendor than I'm putting in here. You know, but I'm going to put this in here because this is what it would cost if it was just a regular, normal vendor relationship, you know? And so you find all these little pockets. And then when things start going wrong, things happen, and I can't even begin to, you know, as well as I do, anybody who makes a film knows it never goes 100% according to plan. Then you have these little pockets that, we have a union flip, you know, we need to find an extra 40 grand somewhere, you know? So, you know, if we take this pad out of here and this pad out of here and we use our contingency and reduce our overtime budget to 5%, then we have the money, you know? So those little pads and pockets are really good.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Now, on the converse, you have to be very careful too. Did not get in the habit of quoting the department heads the wrong misleading numbers. So let's say you have, you know, a $5,000, you know, budget for the wardrobe department, You know, it's very easy to get in the habit of saying that you have 3,000 and then try to act, keep that as pad. And if they go over, let's say they go over 1,000, then you're still 1,000 under. And I've done that a lot, but it's a habit I'm trying to get myself off of, because if you can be just fully transparent, these are the same numbers as my budget. If you're dealing with professionals, like, that's a much better and more effective way to go. So you have to be careful where you put those pads, that they're you know, that you're not depending on somebody else to overperform in order to have that pad. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree with you on the professional standpoint. Like, if you're dealing with union professionals or people who are very seasoned, I get that. But maybe when you're dealing on a lower budget film where the department heads aren't as seasoned, that technique might work. And this is the art of being a line producer. This is this little...
It is part of the art of line producing.
Yeah, it's the art of line producing, because you've got to kind of like, okay, you got to check out the crew, check out what's going on, check out the director, check out the producer. How much experience do these people have? Do you think they're going to go over? And things like that. And sometimes you have to have those little tricks in order to keep, because it's your job.
I'm not saying I never do it anymore, but I have a line producer whose work I really highly respect and is operates at a higher level than me. And, you know, he told me, like, I always give them my real numbers. And I was like, wow. It was just like, wow. You know, like, okay. It was sort of like you having that conversation with that AD, and you just sort of, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. I see why, you know, at the top level, this is the way it works. You know?
Right. Yeah. Like when I was talking to Ridley Scott's costume designer, you can give her, she's an Oscar winner, you can give her the exact budget.
You can give her your real
You don't
numbers.
Play around with someone of that caliber, because they're professionals. They've done this 1,000 times. It's fine. But if you've got someone who's maybe done one or two shows and you just don't know, you've got to protect not only yourself, but it's your job to make sure that this ship doesn't sink. And if you don't have that leeway that you're just talking about, that contingency, when stuff happens, which will happen, and every project it will happen, then the whole thing can come crashing down. Like, you can't finish the movie. So in many ways, I mean, that's a lot of pressure on the line producer, really, truly. It truly is a lot of pressure on the UPM and the line producer, because they've got to, they're responsible for keeping the engine going. They're not the creative producer. They're the nuts and bolts producer.
Well, and it's interesting too, because often the crew will consider them the enemy and that think that they're trying to get over on them or manipulate them, which is one of the reasons why I was saying, like, it's best when you can give the real numbers. But what I always say to the crew that's unhappy with me because I'm not giving them all the things that they want,
right,
is that I'm in charge of making sure your last paycheck clears, right? If we spend all the money and your paycheck bounces, like, that's, you don't want that to happen any more than I do. So if I tell you that we don't have the money, we don't have the money, you know, and we can't talk about it anymore.
Right. And a lot of times, especially when you have crews that are coming in from the studio system who are just used to all the toys, and they also know the depth that a studio has. They're like, oh, if you go over 100,000, no one's going to blink too much. If you go over a million, there's going to be a conversation, but the movie's going to get finished. You're going to get your final check from Universal.
Right.
But when you're in the indie world, when the money runs out, you better go find some dentist.
Right. It's true. It's absolutely true. Yeah. I've been there, and it's painful.
Especially when, you know, and then the poor director and the poor cast and the poor creatives behind everything, they're just like, what's going on? So it's truly one of the more important positions you can higher on, is a good line producer who knows how to play with the numbers and make things work. And it is, I mean, watching my line producing first AD mentor work on that project all those years ago, I would just see how he would just move. And let's not even get into scheduling. That is a whole other art form, between schedules and this and that and the actor and the location. And, oh God, you know, this, One of our issues that we had was like, oh, the turtles are in mating season and we can't shoot on the water, so we have to move things around. Like, it was, these are the things you have to deal with. This is the non-sexy stuff.
Right. True.
This is the stuff that we're talking about. It's so unsexy, because all they teach in film school is like, look at the cool lens, let's watch Citizen Kane,
look at the new Red and the Alexa, and let's go watch a Darren Aronofsky movie, and wax poetic about it. But at the end of the day, this is what makes the movies. This is what gets these movies finished.
And it's what they don't teach you is that sometimes a small hand prop can grind the entire production down to the halt. To a halt. You know, like, you know, it's like, you know, the director didn't see it that, you know, before it's needed on camera, the prop person brings it and the director's like, I can't work with this. This is not what I need for this scene. And then production stops until somebody runs out and gets exactly what the director needs, you know? And yeah, they don't teach you that in film school.
Not at all. Now, what was, in your opinion, one of the worst days you've ever had on set? I know, like a shiver went down his spine.
I've done 65 movies, 400 short form content. So
you've done a lot. Is there one that stands out? And then also, how did you overcome it? Like, that's always my question. Yeah. Like, and how did you overcome it that day?
Okay, that those are good questions. So I'll start the hardest one that I eventually did overcome was hired by somebody, you know, very very late in the prep process, like we got to shoot next week, kind of late, and find out after shooting 3 weeks that they had spent all the money that they were given to make the movie, all but like 40 or 50 grand on, I don't know what, I suspect leisurely activities, for lack of a better word. And, but that they, and it was a foreign production and they didn't have an American LLC. So I formed an LLC just to put all this money through and so that we could operate as an American production. And then basically, you know, actually it was like a 3 week shoot, and 2 weeks into it, I realized the money isn't there. There's no money, you know? And it was right before Christmas. And I had about 130 people who weren't paid. And it was all on me. I was the LLC sole member of the LLC. And it was all on me. And wow, I woke up every morning in so much pain. And I had to go and just knock on doors 24/7 until I got the money to pay the people. And it took like 3 months, you know, and then the money to finish the film. So that's something that you never want to go through. But it, you know, you come out of it stronger. Like I've had so many experiences. The other story I want to tell about is the time we blew up a town, like literally. But I'll tell that story and then just say that, you know, now when I go onto a shoot, you know, there's very little that phases me. One of my favorite movies is, you know, Wag the Dog, where Dustin Hoffman plays the producer. And, you know, there'll be a problem that will come up in what they're trying to do in that movie. And I'll go like, this is nothing. You know, I was shooting 4 Horsemen of the Apocalypse and 3 of the horsemen died. This is nothing. You know, and... And that's the way you start to feel, is like, you know, whatever the problems come up, you're like, look, I lived through this thing, I lived through that thing, we're going to get through this somehow. One of my mottos now is like, a problem cannot existentially exist without a solution. You know, like it's not possible for a problem to exist without there being a solution. So, you know, that's the attitude I took. We were doing this movie, The Alphabet Killer. fun movie. It's a good movie. I'm very proud of it. And our grip truck was pulling out of the parking lot after we'd packed up one location. We were doing a company move to another location where we were shooting Martin Donovan and Melissa Leo, who we only had for one day. Like, they were going back to their other projects or whatever at the next morning.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
The grip truck grabs a power line, pulls the power line, 2 telephone poles with transformers snap. Now, what I didn't know is that transformers are full of oil. So when they hit the ground, they exploded. And the explosion The oil like flew onto our still photographer's car and completely incinerated his car, incinerated the hotel next to the location we were at. We had, you know, a huge, luckily, thank goodness, nobody was hurt, but a huge fireball like came towards our first AD, our second AD, and like burned off her eyebrows. And, you know, this fire mayhem, the explosion was enormous. You could hear it miles away, you know, and we had to get, we only had Melissa Leo for one day. And so, first of all, we made sure everybody was okay.
Sure, of course.
Anybody who was traumatized, we told them, go back to the hotel, right? Then I had to go and talk to the fire department, and who had now cordoned off, you know, like several square blocks. And I was like, look, is there any way I can get to my camera truck to pull off my camera, because we have to keep shooting? And he's like, okay, we'll let you, you know, we'll have an escort. You can go and pull out your camera. What he didn't realize, he thought it was a camera. It was actually 15 cases.
Of course.
And so I grabbed the hand truck, and I'm like pulling 15 cases off and like throwing them onto the hand truck. The fire guy who came with me is looking at me like, I can't believe you are doing this right now. We freaking pulled the camera out. I think there was a supplemental truck. Maybe it was the grip truck that pulled down the thing. And we had an electric truck that had lights and enough grip gear to get by. Did the company move, got Martin and Melissa, made our day, you know. And the insurance claim was like, oh, the funny thing is right after it happened, you know, it was just mayhem. I turned to Martin Donovan and I said, can you believe this? And he's like, no, this is like the second time this has happened to me. Anyhow, we made our day. You know, the insurance claim went on for years. The city was battling the film insurance company because, you know, the film company's position was that the line should never have been hanging low enough for the truck to grab it. You know, the city's insurance company felt like we were driving in a place that we shouldn't have been driving, and therefore it was our fault. So that went on for years and years. But, you know, again, one of those experiences that you make your way through and you become a stronger, you know, like,
producer.
Okay, we didn't pull up the town this time, and, you know, everything's okay, you know.
And another lesson is make sure you have production insurance. Make sure you have production insurance. Yeah,
definitely.
Do not go anywhere without production insurance. Now, you've worked on a ton of movies over the years. Can you, you know, and you've seen the business change. I mean, you were there when DVD was the king and you could just put something out.
Before DVD was king, yeah.
Yeah, but like when that was like the heyday when everybody was making just obscene amounts of money is during the, I'm going to say the late 80s, late 90s to probably like 2010. That's when you could just pre-sell stuff and DVD sales. Like you could make Sniper 52 and it just would go and get sold all over the world. Obviously you're making movies now as well. How important is it to have bankable stars in your films? And I mean, obviously that's a kind of a dumb question, because we all like, hey, we need stars in our movie, but it all depends on the, I always tell people it depends on the budget and the genre.
Right.
If you're making you can make action, you can make horror, you can make thrillers with maybe some recognizable faces or even some unknowns if the budget's low. But once you start breaking a certain budget threshold, it's irresponsible of you in today's world not to have some sort of bankable cast. What do you think?
Well, talent is the coin of the realm. So you it doesn't just matter to the people selling the film. Like I make indie films, so the normal sort of by the numbers process is you make the film. You get into a big film festival, you get a sales agent, you get a publicist, you go to the festival, you create a lot of hype, you sell it to a distributor, they put it out, right? Film festivals, when they look at your movie, are thinking, who is going to bring the most press to my film festival? So it's not even the people who are buying it. The sales agent is looking at your film and saying, it's a good film, but I don't know anybody in it. And, you know, you're going to have to go find another agent. You know, like it ripples in all these, you know, the publicists, the casting. You would be surprised. Even like if you go to a, you know, one of the top casting directors and you say, I've got this great movie that, you know, and it's got this person already attached, you know, versus I've got this great movie and nobody's attached. It could be the difference between like that top casting director saying yes or no to your project, you know? So it's not just, you can't just think about it in terms of the name on the DVD box cover or on the thumbnail on the streaming service. You know, it ripples all the way down, you know, and you find you get better crew too. It's like, oh, this has got a project with that name in it. Okay, I'm in, you know, but whereas, well, you know, the pay's okay, or it's not usually what I get, but, you know, and there's nobody in it, you know, I'll do a commercial that week, you know, and make more money than, you know, in one day than I would make a week on your film, you know, so it matters all the way down the line, unfortunately. However, not everybody can do it. And it's not easy. You know, it's getting cast attached can take forever. And, you know, it's a big rigmarole. And if you can't do that, and if your budget's so small or whatever, you can't do that, then you have to do something innovative like you did, you know, putting it as an app on the iStream. You know, I know a guy who figured out SEO. This was years ago. He did a wrestling movie with no stars. But what he did was, you know, he knew how to work Google so that anytime somebody typed in wrestling, the first result would be his movie. And you went to his website and you bought it for $30. And
sure, he did
and
well.
He spent $300,000 to make the movie, and he sold $1 million worth of DVDs, you know? And so if you don't have that, you better have like a unique and well thought out business plan of how you will recoup your money without me.
Right. And then that's why I wrote a whole book about being a filmtrepreneur, which is about finding a niche and finding a niche and serving that niche. And you don't need to have, you know, Adrian Brody in your film, if you have a movie that is focused on a specific audience that, you know, and I always use the Vegan Chef movie as my example, but something along those lines where you could target that audience. So it is doable. But again, that also limits on budget. I wouldn't suggest doing a $5 million budget film with no stars attached or no bankable stars attached for a filmtrepreneur release unless you have deep connections into and a massive niche audience that you can sell to. It's not impossible, but it's so, I mean, you know how hard it is to make $1 million in rentals, AVOD and TVOD and SVOD. It's tough with no stars.
Right.
It's tough in today's world. It's just too much competition.
And it's true. It's true. Although this gives me a great, because you brought up Adrian, this gives me a great opportunity to pivot to the movie that I got coming out tomorrow, which is Clean, and it stars Adrian Brody. And having him on board changed a lot of things. You know, you know, we want CAA to be the sales agent. I went and screened it with their film division, you know, in their screening room, you know, the festivals were a lot more, you know, like, and we got, you know, we got our casting director, sort of like that I was saying, is a top casting director who came on board because they wanted that relationship, you know, and just all the way down the line, it opened doors and opportunities. Just on top of that, Adrian is a phenomenal creative partner and is works harder than anybody else to ensure the success of the movie, you know, which is the fringe benefit of it. It's not just the name. It's also what they're bringing to, they're a name for a reason, you know, like they're bringing, you know, all this knowledge, expertise, connections, and benefits just in terms of, because they have, distinguished themselves through talent and hard work, you know?
Yeah. I was going to ask you about Clean, cause I saw the trailer for it and it's going to be in the show notes if everybody wants to watch it. It looks badass. It looks really beautifully produced and beautifully shot, beautifully performed. I mean, it just looks like it looks like a $30 or $40 million movie, which I know wasn't that budget. But not even remotely close. But I'm a huge fan of it. But I'm a huge fan of Adrian's. I mean, I think he's not only a phenomenal actor, but he's got that presence about him on screen. And when I saw the trailer, I was just like, damn, this looks like I am really honestly looking forward to seeing it. It's like, that's a Friday night movie. That's a Saturday night movie for me.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I'm excited about it. How did you get involved with it, man? How did you get involved with that project?
Well, first of all, please go see it. It's the best movie I've ever made. You know, And it really delivers. And production value aside, you know, like hopefully you always want the movie to look better than the money that you had, you know. But you know, the story just is just rock solid. The script was in such a great place even before we started to do pre-production. And then Paul Solette, and this is how I got involved. So I did another movie with the co-writer director Paul Solette called Dark Summer. And Paul and I, you know, connected and hit it off. And then he went off to do a movie for Avi Lerner called Bullethead that had Adrian, Antonio Banderas, and John Malkovich. And through that experience, you know, him and Adrian started talking about something that Adrian had been wanting to do for a long time, you know, create a character that he didn't feel like he was being cast as, you know. And a lot of these projects are sort of cast centered. Like often I'll find an independent, it's very common in independent film that a movie is given birth by an actor who really feels like either they're not getting enough recognition and they want to raise their profile, or like Adrian, it's like people think of me as this like really sensitive guy, and you know, I like to be a tough guy, you know. I enjoy playing with guns, I enjoy doing, you know, these tough guy things. And so like this is something that he really, you know, really passionately wanted to do, show this side to him. You know, it also gave him a chance to grow a beard, which, you know, if you're ever in the casting process, it's always like if the actor has a beard, it's like, OK, they got to cut their beard or else we're not going to cast.
Right.
So he
right.
got a chance to like grow a beard, you know. And so Adrian and Paul like decide they want to make this movie. You know, they had somebody that showed the willingness to put up the budget, and then Paul contacted me. He said, you know, Daniel, I really think you'd be good to do this. You know, you should really meet Adrian, which was one of the most nerve-wracking days of my life. Was where okay, you know, we're coming over to your house, you know. It's like my house, like how do I get my house ready for an Oscar winner? Like, do I have hors d'oeuvres? Like, you know, like, you know, like, and I have a kid, so like it's got to be like clean, you know. Like it was a little unnerving. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, like how do I prepare for an Oscar winner to come to my house? But as it turned out, you know, Adrian's just an angel, and it was all about the work from the moment they stepped through the door, you know. And I didn't have to worry about anything. Like my house was definitely fine, you know.
Awesome.
But we had a conversation, you know, you know, I said, well, you know, like I asked, like, what other producers are on this? And they said, well, you know, we're both going to get producer credit, but, you know, like there were no other like producers on it. I'm like, you know, gosh, guys, you know, I want to make this movie. I'd love to make this movie. But, you know, producing movies like pushing a huge rock up a hill. You know, you need to have more, you know, as many hands as you can get on it, you know. You know, and it is. It's, I'm still, you know, we're coming out tomorrow, and I just sent the distributor some delivery requirements still. You know, it's still like, I'm not, you know, these hands trying to push the rock over the hill, you know. But anyhow, so that they, whatever I said or did, or, you know, they seemed that I would be a good fit for the film, and, you know, and then we went off and we made it, you know.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. I'm so happy for you because it looks fantastic. And, you know, when you reached out to me, I'm like, hey, I got this new movie with Adrian Brody, and do you want to have me talk about it? I was like, oh yeah, this would be awesome. This would be a great conversation to have you come on. Were you involved in the financing and raising money, or was the money in place before?
I'm a physical producer, so usually the money is in place before it comes to me. I'm the person that can take a script through distribution and know all the details of what needs to go to make that happen. I have raised money on occasion, but it's not really, that's why I like to have a lot of producers. Everybody has their strengths. There's some people that are just good rainmakers. Like I don't consider myself one of them.
Got it. Now, and when does it come out?
Tomorrow night, today, which is January 28th. So yeah.
It's going to be on theaters. There's going to be.
Yeah. We're on 260 screens around the country. iTunes and Amazon simultaneously.
Okay. So it's a day and date.
Day and date. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So you can't go watch it and rent it as well.
Yes. Yeah. You can go to the theater. You can rent it.
Awesome, man. That's awesome. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
I would say there's nothing to it but to do it. You know, just make movies. You know, don't wait to be greenlit. I would say that just do as much as you can. You know, like when I was at NYU Film School, I was there, a lot of the, my fellow students were like, oh, I'm not going to PA or I'm not going to do this. And I was like, I'll PA, I'll do that, I'll do this, I'll run self-security, you know, like just do as much as you can to get in where you fit in and do as much as you can. And you'll get a network and you'll start elevating yourself. So, you know, I think, and I would say too, producing is an entry-level position. Like you can start producing today. You know, you don't have to wait till you climb a ladder to get there. If you want to produce, you know, you can go and produce something right now. I guarantee you.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Well, what I always say is that I don't feel like there's a lot that I need to learn about the technical aspects of filmmaking, but I've never learned enough about people. You know, if you can really focus on how to interact and with people in a way that is, like I was saying, about a win-win situation, or, you know, if you can learn how to like really work well with people, play well with others, you know, you will do great, you know? And so that's, I still am learning that today, you know, how to continue to like learn how to play well with others, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I've said this 1,000 times on the show, but I never get tired of saying it. Best advice I ever heard. Don't be a dick.
Because nobody wants to work. You know, you might get through this movie, but then nobody will want to work with you on the next one.
It is too small. Right. It's a very small business. It's a
small business.
Very small.
Very small. Run into the same people over and over again.
Yeah, and it's so funny. And now that I've had this show for so many years, you know, I'll watch something or I'll talk to somebody and they're like, oh, he's on that project. Oh, he's been on the show. Or I know that person. Or I've worked with that person or this or that. I've just been around, you know, I've been around close to 30 years as well. So it's just like at a certain point, you run into a lot of different people in this business.
It's true.
And don't be a dick. Don't screw anybody over. It will come back to bite you.
And there are a lot of people who wash out that the film business is not for them. But the people who stay, you run into those people over and over and over and over again.
Absolutely. And three of your favorite films of all time.
Contact, Apocalypse Now, and Lawrence of Arabia.
Good trio. Good. That's a good movie night. That's a good movie night.
Great movie night. Or just watch the whole Alien franchise from beginning to end.
Oh, you know? God. I mean, Alien and Aliens. Jesus, man. If you want to read a great action script, near perfection is Aliens. Cameron's Aliens. Yeah. It's just the script is just perfection, man.
What's great about too, when you watch all the movies back to back, you see Ripley's character arc.
Just Oh yeah.
Over the course of the film, so that. In the beginning, she's terrified of these aliens. And, you know, by the third movie, she realizes that, like, please kill me. You know, like I just keep waking up and having to deal with this nightmare, you know. And yeah,
it's amazing. Daniel, man, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. It has been great catching up with you, man. And I think you've dropped a few knowledge bombs on the tribe today, and hopefully we'll help some young producers and young filmmakers out there, man. So thank you, my friend.
Well, and if you want more, I'm on TikTok, Producer Daniel. So I go every day and drop a little bomb every day. So if people want more, they can get it there.
We will put it on the show notes, my friend. Thank you again.
All right, man. You take care.
I want to thank Daniel so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Daniel. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/557. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.